Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, host of Soundbites on Delmarva. This week, we're going to focus on organic food and organic agriculture. A recent Stanford University Medical School study found that organic food was no more nutritious than conventionally farm food. It caused a huge controversy, and almost every major media outlet picked up this report and has been using it to make some pretty huge assumptions about organic foods and farming. While many might agree that in today's world, with what we know, organic food may not be more nutritious than conventional food, some have also argued that the report left out a great many facts. But before we get into the meat of this report, let's take a little trip back into history. We visit with Nick Maribel of Nick's Organic Farm in Montgomery County. During our conversation, he gave us a brief history of how organic farming and its ideas started in the Western world.
30 years ago, as I think I mentioned to you before, you couldn't use the O word in polite company, organic. USDA virtually had no research on organic methods going on, and then we started to change that. But what I'm finding is that if you go back and read older texts, that some of the elements, the principles that you need are there. The science is not as advanced because they didn't have the methods and the tools, the measurement techniques, et cetera, that we have now. But there were scientists. D.H. King, who wrote Farmers of 40 Centuries at the turn of the 20th century, he retired. And he was the head of the Soils Bureau at USDA. And once he went retired, just like when the professors go emeritus, they get to do what they, the research that they're driven to do by their passion. Well, we had discovered enough about synthetic, what they called manures back then, which were what we now call chemical fertilizers. And the debate going on was, well, should we be using these synthetic manures in preference to the more traditional manures, whether they be green manures, which is things that are alive and green and you turn into the ground, brown manures, which is what we saw out there in the field after you cut it and let it dry and it's on the ground, or animal manures, which are obviously the manure from animals that you're managing. But all of those are organic matter going back into the ground. And so he said, well, should we be doing those? And there was a debate going on with the science, the soil scientists, or should we be going more towards using synthetic manures produced through industrial processes? And he said, you know, China, Korea, and Japan have been at this. He could have added India, but he didn't. Sir Albert Howard did India, but D.H. King, Sir Albert Howard was from the British side. But D.H. King was on the American side of the Atlantic, and he went and he studied their agriculture because he said, you know, they've always had a very dense population, relatively constrained land bases, particularly Japan, and yet they're highly productive per square foot or per square acre, however you want to measure it. They're not using tractors, and they're not using synthetic manures. Let's go and take a look. And he took pictures, and he took measurements, and he met with the officials of the agricultural ministries and of the universities, and he talked with the farmers, and he documented what they were doing and how they were doing it. Now, granted, these are methods which were done by what we would consider to be done by hand. They were not highly mechanized methods. But the principles that they were using can be instructive. And so what he found is, guess what? They're returning all organic matter to the soil, whether it's human manure, whether it's dredging the bottom of the canals that they use to transport the produce into the cities, and then they use those same canals to transport the manures generated in the cities back out to the farms, whether it's the weeds growing around the fields or on the banks of the canals. They would harvest those weeds and put them down on the surface. So they were composting. They were not just putting these down in random fashion. They actually had structures built to mix soil and organic matter in certain formulas to create compost and spread that on the field. They were also doing something that we're now saying is, you know, a good innovative type of practice called vertical growing, which just means you trellis things and you plant shorter things facing the sun and a little bit higher behind that and a little bit higher behind that. And they mixed, they intermixed some of their planting so that they didn't have monocultures. Well, all of those things worked, and they would sometimes get 3 or 4 seasons of product, whereas in similar climate, not identical, but similar climate in America, we might only get 1 or 2 because they were managing their land much more intensively. Well, by managing it more intensively, you run the risk of wearing it out, of using it up. But after 40 centuries, he said, they hadn't done that. They'd been there as a civilization for 40 centuries, and their soils were not used up. So they had something. Well, my only point here is that D.H. King had to go back to the what would be considered now the emerging world or the third world to have all those pieces fit in his mind as to how they were working. Sir Albert Howard did the same thing from the British side in India and developed what is known as the indoor. That doesn't mean inside. It's the name of a province in India. The indoor composting system. And both of these gentlemen were extremely talented soil scientists who said, you know, there's other things going on here and we really need to pay attention. And so, for example, Sir Albert Howard said, there seems to be a relationship between some fungal association, which we now know are the mycorrhizal fungi, and the ability of the roots of plants to scavenge for their nutrients. See, because, you know, at first blush you might think, well, a fungus on a plant, that could be bad news. But he was hypothesizing that it was not only good news in the rhizosphere, in the area around the roots, particularly the small little root hairs, but that it was essential. And that you needed to do things to foster that type of microbiological activity, not introduce a chemical, for example, that might set back that biological activity. And so I just find it interesting that both Sir Albert Howard and D.H. King, who Sir Albert Howard was maybe a generation after that. He was younger than D.H. King. How they, in effect, needed to go to other cultures seen as less advanced than Britain or the United States to rediscover the roots that had not been lost elsewhere. So we're now here in the United States, you know, we've got a situation where organic and sustainable agriculture has become a much more accepted practice. USDA has $25 to $50 million a year going into research to support organic systems, whereas, you know, when I started out, I don't think you could. I don't know if you could find any. So we're now able to recognize the value. But in terms of how we manage our energy, how we manage our environment, and how we manage our health, and the relationship to our soil, our water, and our plants, and our animals. And because of that, I'm very hopeful that we'll continue to grow local, sustainable, and organic agricultural, you know, activities.
That was Nick Maribel of Mix Organic Farm, and you'll be hearing more from him in the coming weeks as we explore his farm and other issues that he's concerned about. But now we'll hear from farmers themselves about how they see organic farming and conventional farming, with two men who have joined us in the past to share their very different views about how both organic farming and conventional farming fit into the future of agriculture, and whether or not the Stanford study is really as big a deal as everyone is making it to be. We're joined by Ted Wyckoff of Green Branch Organic Farm and James Atkins of the Wicomico County Young Farmers. So recently there was this Stanford University report that said that organic food was no more nutritious than traditionally farmed food. So, I mean, what was your reaction to it? I'm curious, and I'm curious, Jim, James, after that, what was your reaction to it?
I mean, I didn't really have that much of a reaction to it. It's, it doesn't surprise me. It's like every 3 weeks something else comes out that says one thing, and then 3 weeks later another study comes out that says another thing, and you know, they'll contradict each other. And I've just kind of learned to brush it all aside. It just doesn't, I don't know, it doesn't persuade me one way or the other. I think just the way that the story was rolled out, where it was on ABC News, NBC News, CNN, Fox, Clear Channel Radio, I mean, it was everywhere. The way that it was rolled out, I mean, this was like a major rollout for the press. This is like a press release. You know, somebody wanted to really get this out there. Other studies that have been done on the same topic really have not had the same type of rollout. So that was kind of suspect to me, but otherwise, it's. I mean, I wouldn't disagree with the findings entirely. I mean, farming is so complex that, you know, somebody that grows conventionally on good volcanic soil or good glacial soils that are fairly young soils or will have very nutritionally rich food. Somebody that farms organically on very poor, washed out soils, such as the southeastern United States or here on the Delmarva. We still have great soil, don't get me wrong, but, you know, it lacks a lot of things that younger soils would have. And that basis alone, just the physical medium of the soil itself, could account for a lot of nutritional differences. It doesn't really have a whole lot to do with organic or non-organic. I do think organic farmers will really try to, at least good organic farmers would really try to add those minerals that are that have been leached out of the soil. Good conventional farmers would probably do the same, but... just from what I've, you know, seen that it's such an individual basis. You know, each farm is different. So to categorize things organic versus non-organic, and it could be potentially very misleading.
James, what was your reaction when you first saw the story?
I mean, it was much like Ted. I wasn't terribly surprised. The results were basically what every conventional farmer has probably been thinking for quite some time, that when it comes down to the nutritional value of the crop, that there isn't a whole lot of difference. Obviously, there should be a difference in the pesticides, and that's to be expected.
So let me tell you what a couple of farmers have said to me as we talked to them about this. If you're talking about organic farms that do rotational crops and animals in rotation, and over the years build a soil that is nutritious and doesn't use sprays of any kind, then you're talking about something very different than monocrop organic farming?
Well, first of all, I think the rotational aspects of organic agriculture are being used in traditional ag as well. We do not like to see the same crop on the same field multiple years in a row. Now, obviously, there's not a lot of guys that are rotating in, say, a pasture crop or something like that, but it does happen. So there's definitely a movement within the conventional sector of agriculture to move field soils with cover crops and other programs to help their soil become more healthy for the same goals as what the organic farmers are doing. So this notion that there's going to be strawberries in a field perpetually in the same field for, you know, 20 years or something of that nature, while it may happen on a few select occasions, that's not the predominant method in which American agriculture works.
Ted?
Crop rotation is one of the oldest practices in agriculture, and I do think the more complex the rotations get, the better. Generally speaking, we see very simple rotations now. But building soils is very important. And as I talked about earlier, is testing your soil and looking at what's in there and then addressing any deficiencies is one of the most important things in my mind. So a lot of people only test for a very small spectrum of nutrients and minerals, and I think it's important to look at, you know, as many as we can possibly test for, which is about 23, and then all 23 of those elements need to be brought up into proper ratios and proper amounts in the soil, and that's the way that nutrition is built in the soil. And then when you add soil building practices such as cover cropping, such as composting, on top of that, then what you're doing is you're keeping those trace minerals available to your cash crops. So the vegetables can actually consume that, and once the vegetables can consume that, then it's in that vegetable for you, the consumer, to benefit from.
Large farms typically are doing the more intensive soil analysis and micronutrient packages to maintain that soil balance. They may not be applying cover crops at the level that an organic farm would be, but typically your large commercial operations that are producing especially high-value specialty crops like strawberries or peaches or anything of that nature are doing some very intensive management through soil testing and micronutrients.
Yeah, that could be possible on the conventional side. I think on the organic side, from what I've seen, it's generally speaking the smaller ones that can, you know, manage. It's a smaller scale that's more easily managed, because a lot of times the mineral amendments that one would have to put down can be kind of pricey. It's a lot of bulk to have to import. So if you were trying to cover 1,000 acres with a rock mineral, I mean, you would have to bring it in on a freight train. So a smaller scale farm can, you know, just bring it in on the back of a, you know, an 18-wheeler or whatever.
Well, that kind of goes against the law of supply and demand. I mean, things get cheaper as you buy them in bulk. So under that argument, if you need more of that mineral for the larger organic farm, you ought to be able to get it cheaper than the small guy.
It can just be a logistical complication. I mean, it's like whether or not you live close enough to the mine itself. I mean, if you have to bring it in from Utah or something like that, it could be really complicated. So the smaller scale farms have a lot more options, I think.
What some people are saying is that what determines the nutritious value of food and even the taste of the food, Ted, then we'll go to James, is the soil, right?
Okay. Yeah, I would agree. As long as the soils are in good shape, yeah, it should be great.
In some ways, James, would you disagree that size makes a difference in that way?
Well, I would agree wholeheartedly with your comment that the small operation is able to provide something with a little more taste. But the
and nutrition,
the concern that I have is you're comparing a little bit to something you buy in a grocery store, which is probably bred and grown for that shipping nature of that. So, you know, if it's coming in January to Maryland from Florida, who knows how long it had to sit on a truck. So they're going to sacrifice some flavor. They're going to sacrifice some nutrition in order to have the shelf life in order to be able to be marketable in these out of region areas. We got to make sure we're comparing apples to apples here.
Well, I would say on the day of harvest, you could do a comparison.
What do you mean?
Right in the field, you could probably find differences. I know that using there's certain equipment that you can use, refractometers and tissue samples and that kind of thing. I mean, you can find out sugar levels. You can find out nutritional levels. So, I mean, there's certainly tools to test this theory. I have never done it. I've never done a comparison of organic versus conventional. What I have done is I've done the taste test, and generally speaking, you know, organic produce has been really excellent. Everything that we've grown has been pretty good. I'm not saying everything, but a lot of the things that we grow are really great. So when I crack an egg that's, you know, raised in a free-range model, it looks different. The yolk is much more orange. It stands up taller. The whites are fluffier. You know, grass-fed milk is going to have an orange appearance because of the diet, and the nutritional density of that product is going to look different. You know, bacon from our hogs cooks up. It basically cooks faster because it has a lower saturated fat content. And that's because of the diet. So, I mean, it depends on what we're talking about. If we're going to talk about produce, and we can get into soils and that kind of thing, and if we want to talk about livestock products, it's a different thing. But generally speaking, I would say the more holistic the approach, the better the results.
James, you have a small plot where you grow really delicious vegetables in a very traditional way, correct?
Yes.
I've eaten them, and I like them. And I feel like I've eaten Ted's, and I like his, too. So you have that. But now when you talk about soils and rotation of crops, you're talking about, though, in larger farms, in America and the Eastern Shore and across the country, where you're growing primarily corn and soy and then rotating those and letting a field go fallow and then putting cover crops on, you're talking about raising large quantities of soy and corn for animal feed and other, for want of a better term, industrial use. By that I mean by companies that make things out of them. And but yeah. That's different than the organic farming, which is making food going directly to market, and also different in terms of the amounts of pesticides you would use to make that happen. Correct?
Yeah.
That is why it seems to me so difficult for these kind of studies to kind of get to the heart of all of this.
And one of the things that further complicates things is when we look at your corn and soybean example here in a conventional scenario, we cannot produce the volume and the quantity of corn and soybeans we need to feed the animals we have here under our organic production system without some fundamental changes to the whole system, meaning more farmers. The last study I saw out of United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization said that in order to produce the same volume of food in the United States organically versus conventional methods, we would have to go from 2 million farmers that we have currently to about 140 million farmers to do the same quantity of food. And that's more of a social issue than it is an organic versus conventional issue that really isn't what's being talked about here.
Go ahead, Ted.
Like I was saying earlier, there are studies that say a lot of things. But I would, you know, from my own personal perspective, the system we have now is inherently flawed, and it would be very inefficient to run the system we have now organically. As far as feeding, growing grain to feed to livestock, I would think that chicken and pork would occupy a much smaller space in our diet if we were to do things organically, and we would probably be eating a lot more meat that was produced from herbivores, cows, sheep, goats, even rabbits. The root of the problem is that we have a system that's built on this grain. This subsidized grain production that probably wouldn't be, it wouldn't even exist without the subsidies that, you know, I mean, this is a massive market distortion that we're looking at here. So to say that, you know, we could just switch it to organic tomorrow and see what happens, it's just, there's no way.
Because I think that's what people are wondering about. There's this whole movement, whether it's the United Nations or across the country, talking about organic farming or more natural farming or small-scale farming, what it would take for that to be the transformative farming for America, and could it be, is the question. That's where the jury is still out. How would that even happen?
Yeah, the first step would be to get rid of subsidies.
And you've said that before as well.
Yeah. It's very important, so.
And I don't think a lot of the conventional farmers would disagree with that to some degree.
Really?
No, I do not think that they would have a big problem with doing away with the subsidies for corn and soybeans. Likewise, I don't think at this point that if you did away with all the agricultural subsidies that go to grain production, that you would see a whole lot of shift from corn and soybeans to organic production of any crop. I think the market is there. Folks know how to produce it. They can produce it very economically, which is what the world wants right now. You know, we've got a lot of people to feed, and it's getting to be more every day, and we have the moral obligation to provide an economical food source. I don't think if the subsidies is such a small percentage of the income to a grain producer's bottom line that I don't think that taking that away is going to change a lot of how that's produced.
I would say in the past it's probably been a larger portion of the income than it is today. Today the commodity prices are so high that it's really irrelevant because the subsidies are so small in comparison. But, I mean, we've been living a long time with a distorted marketplace, and I think what we're seeing now, the problems that we're seeing with our nutrition, you know, as a society, the rates of obesity, the rates of disease, these types of things are kind of the results of a farming system that's been transformed through market manipulation.
Well, I think the things we've been talking about in terms of organic farming and its future, and also the issues that both of you, James Atkins and Ted Weichel, just now have raised, are kind of This is at the heart of it all, and whether or not the kind of small-scale farming can actually feed America and the world, what we're already seeing is the question. That's one of the things we've been trying to examine over the last year, and we'll continue to examine to figure out for with all of us and our listeners, because a lot of studies coming out is also saying that even with large-scale farming, 15 to 20% of the world's population lives in hunger, and 15% of the U.S. population still has no access to food or has or lives live in food deserts. So, I mean, those issues are among us even with this larger system of industrial agriculture. I don't even like using the word industrial agriculture. Even this larger system of agriculture we have in America, we're still facing hunger here and abroad.
I agree. We have a moral obligation to provide economical food for the world. Like you said, the biggest health issue there is in the world right now is hunger. And I think in order for us to meet the demands, from what I understand, in about 50 years, we're going to need to produce twice the amount of food that we are currently. And the only way we're going to be able to do that and on a shrinking land base is to use technology. GMOs, synthetic fertilizers, those types of things are going to be the technology that enables us to double that in the next 50 years. And I don't see organic production really adopting a lot of that technology just simply because of the restrictions of the word organic, that they can't.
And you know, interesting, Ted, because the studies I just started reading this morning from the UN are actually suggesting something different, that what Africa and Asia and other places need to do is to go to small-scale farming, stop growing things for the rest of the world in monocrops, and they can feed themselves without this large-scale farming.
I mean, I totally agree with James that, you know, we have to find ways to feed everybody. It's just, it's something that as farmers we should be trying to do, as just humans we should be trying to do that. I disagree with the techniques. I don't think that GMOs and synthetic fertilizers are the way to go. Absolutely, technology is important, and we need to keep developing that. The technological development has been in the conventional side of farming for a long time now, and I think it's time that it starts investing more into the organic side of farming, because we are at a very, very immense disadvantage as far as funding and technology goes. I think that the scale of the farms we shouldn't really get too bogged down in, because I think the scale of the farm should fit the landscape. Here on the Delmarva, we have a lot of woods and a lot of creeks, and so it doesn't really allow for, you know, massive 5,000-acre fields like one would see in Nebraska or Iowa. So I think the agriculture needs to be designed to fit the landscape, not the landscape needs to be designed to fit the agriculture, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. A lot of this conversation has all made sense. You two are always really very articulate thinkers, and it's always great to have the both of you with us, both James Atkins and you just heard Ted Wycall. Thank you, guys, so much for all your time.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
That was Ted Wycall of Green Branch Organic Farm and James Atkins of the Wicomico County Young Farmers. And right now, we're going to take a very brief break, so don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, your host for Soundbites on Delmarva. As we said earlier, a recent Stanford University medical study found that organic food was no more nutritious than conventional food, though there are many who disagree with this study. We turn to two people with very different views of the Stanford study. Christine Wilcox is a PhD student at the University of Hawaii and writes the Science Sushi blog for Scientific American, his commentary for the New York Times. And Tom Philpott, food and ag blogger for Mother Jones Magazine, co-founder of Maverick Farms. First, here's Christy Wilcox.
I think a lot of misinformation is out there about a lot of different things. And I think that a lot of people are scared, even though they shouldn't be.
What do you mean?
A lot of people are afraid of pesticide residues, and the scientific data just simply doesn't support that fear.
Are you saying that pesticide use is not dangerous?
I think that pesticide use, particularly to the people actually applying the pesticides, can be dangerous. But when you're talking about pesticide risk from foods you eat, not really, no. The percentages that are found on foods are 1% of the average daily intake allowed by the EPA. And to put that number in perspective, that average daily intake is 100 times lower than the highest amount that caused any level of toxicity in any animal when fed over its entire lifetime. So our exposure is 10,000 times lower than the amount that still cause no toxicity in animals.
Well, when other scientists say that, in kind of countering that, because I think that even the Stanford people wouldn't deny the dangers of the toxicity of pesticides, they're just saying that you can still find it in organic products, but at a lower percentage than you can in conventional products, maybe because of how the wind blows. The whole way of looking at the risk difference, some scientists have challenged.
Well, certainly organic foods have been shown to have synthetic pesticide residues, but they also don't take into account that no one actually checks organic foods for organic pesticide residues. And if we're talking about safety, there's absolutely no evidence that organic pesticides are any safer than synthetic ones. If anything, there's some evidence to the contrary.
Well, I mean, the scientific studies I've been reading in, after I read the Stanford study say that most organic pesticides that are used dissipate fairly quickly, that they don't linger, and that the way they're used is in such small amounts that they would affect very little.
That's simply not true. Copper sulfate is one of the most highly used organic compounds, and it's applied in 4 to 10 times higher amounts than synthetic pesticides. It's not only that, it has a strong bioaccumulation potential because it's a heavy metal. Our bodies simply don't process heavy metals.
Well, what about the studies that talk about the evidence of prenatal exposure to organophosphates, insecticides? They are being looked at now as risking a high risk of a range of neurodevelopmental deficits. And there's tons of studies out there about OP exposures in pregnancy and autism and ADHD and asthma and more.
And yet every single study that is compared crosswise, populations of people that eat organic foods and populations of people that eat non-organic foods have found no health impact.
It may have found no health impact, but I'm saying these studies are showing that there is an effect.
There is a possibility for an effect, but only at higher doses than we receive in our food every day.
You find that the idea that there is danger in pesticides is really irrelevant, that we are kind of barking up the wrong scientific tree, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, there's multiple studies that have a lot of meta-analyses say that typical dietary exposure to pesticide residues poses minimal risk.
Going back to some of the conversations that I had earlier today with other folks about this study, while they would kind of agree that maybe the nutritional aspect could be true, that it also doesn't really kind of look at the entirety of organic agriculture, that all it does is look at kind of this kind of monocrop culture.
It's hard to say because when it comes to organic or conventional, the way I see it, neither of those labels really means anything. There's such a wide variety of practices used on both sides. You know, you've got small, conventional, quote-unquote, farms that are, you know, some Joe Schmo in the backyard somewhere, and he, you know, is conventional because he once a year maybe puts some pesticides on there, but overall, let's say he uses very little, whereas then you could also have a giant, you know, industry organic farm that sprays copper sulfate as much as they feel like. I mean, the labels themselves mean very little.
So now tell me why you think that the organic vegetables could be more dangerous than conventional.
I don't think they're less dangerous. I think that there's no hard evidence to support or refute claims that organic food is healthier or safer than conventional food or vice versa. They're equal, except that organic food costs a lot more.
It does cost a bit more. Just a little. So, I mean, even in your own life, are you an organic food buyer? Or are you a
most of the time, I just buy whatever food is ripe, fresh, looks good. If that happens to be the organic, then I'll buy the organic. If it happens to be conventional, I'll buy the conventional.
So, if you were to begin to look at where you think organic food fits into the scheme of things when it comes to conventional food, what do you think should be looked at, and what are you looking at?
First and foremost, if you're looking to eat healthy and especially if you're actually looking to avoid exposure to things, the best way to do that is to actually buy local, not to buy some label in a grocery store. I think industry organic is still industry agriculture. And I believe it was Michael Pollan who said that they're organic to the letter, but not in spirit. And that if organic food consumers were to actually see what goes on in industrial organic farms, that they'd feel like they were being ripped off.
So
buy local.
as much as you can, which can be difficult to do in the wintertime
right.
In most parts of the United States.
Of course.
So, and the risk difference between the two when it comes to pesticides. What about the studies that might talk about conventional fruit and vegetable samples that can contain 2 to 5 residues? Do you see a difference there?
No study has seen any difference comparing dietary exposure to conventional and organic foods. I mean, it's just they've done the cross-sectional analyses. They've done people that eat organic all the time, and they've done people that eat non-organic all the time, and they just can't find any evidence that this exposure that is happening is causing any adverse health effects.
That was Christy Wilcox, who writes the Science Sushi blog for the Scientific American and does commentary for the New York Times. And now we turn to Tom Philpott, food and ag blogger for Mother Jones and co-founder of Maverick Farms.
Well, I think the report pretty significantly understated a couple of the differences between organic and conventional food. And I think that the most glaring thing was that the report, it did find a pretty significant difference in terms of pesticide exposure. And, you know, it calculated what it said was a 30% risk difference between organic and conventional in terms of pesticide exposure. These are the traces of pesticides that end up on food. And that sounds like a pretty substantial difference. But in reality, the difference is much greater than that.
How so?
Well, the basic reality is that there are very few pesticide traces on organic food. And the pesticide traces on conventional fruits and vegetables are it's routine. It's often 2, 3, and 4 pesticide traces found in a single piece of fruit. It's, you know, basically like a high school or undergraduate in mathematics there. The way that they did the numbers, if you look at their raw data, it's 81% more likely to find pesticide traces on a conventional piece of fruit. And this might sound like it doesn't matter that much and that it's trivial because we're talking about very small amounts. But it turns out that when you look at the science, that especially for children, being exposed to these pesticides at low levels at a young age, when their minds are growing and more vulnerable, can have a huge difference on things like IQ and possibly autism rates and things like that. And, you know, a second thing that is worth bringing up is that when you've got traces of multiple pesticides on a single piece of fruit, the EPA doesn't distinguish. What the EPA does is it sets the tolerance level for specific pesticides. But it doesn't have tolerance levels for these kinds of pesticide cocktail. And there's an emerging body of research showing that a cocktail of pesticides, they act synergistically and together in a more powerful fashion than they do individually. And so you're getting a worse effect by having 4 pesticides than you are, say, having 4 times the amount of 1 in some cases. And so all of this is underplayed and understated in that report. In the nutritional part, the study says that organic and conventional fruits and vegetables are pretty equivalent in terms of nutrition. And that's true for most of the big sort of macronutrients and vitamins A, B, and C, and things like that. But there's significant evidence that kind of gets underplayed that these things called phytochemicals, which are the stuff that turns fruits and vegetables, that gives them colors, these things tend to be more concentrated in organic fruits and vegetables. And then, again, there's emerging science that these chemicals help us fight off cancer. They help us prevent cancer, and they help stop cancer from metastasizing when it gets into us. And I think these are pretty important effects that are downplayed in that study.
So what about the comment for a minute about 2 things you just said? I mean, one of the arguments people will make on the against that is that the studies on the effect of these colorings on cancer and also the real effect on pesticides are minimal, and that no studies have really effectively shown those links or the real dangers of pesticides, and that it is kind of supposition on smaller studies that are unproven.
I would say that is wrong, especially on the pesticides, and especially there are studies about developmental difficulties that emerge from low levels of exposure to pesticides in kids. And there is emerging evidence. Now, on the nutritional part about phytochemicals, now one thing is that when you isolate them, you know, the sort of American idea of if something is good, let's isolate it, put it in a pill, and sell it. So you see stuff like antioxidant pills, things like that. Those things don't appear to be very effective when you isolate these things. But in the context of a piece of fruit or a vegetable, there is plenty of evidence in science that these phytochemicals do have positive effects. And I've written about that, too, on the Mother Jones blog.
I'm curious what effect you think this has on our consciousness, on this debate around organic and conventional food, when this is picked up by written by a major medical journal, but picked up by most newspapers in America, and how it affects our discussions and debates on this issue.
I think it's pretty unfortunate. I mean, I think what it does is it sort of people take in headlines and there were a lot of headlines that went around about basically organic is no different. And especially in a time of a bad economy and people are trying to save money, I think it gives people sort of an incentive to not think about organics. And I think that ends up being pretty negative. I think that the thing about the study is that it just looks at one aspect of that sort of organic versus conventional debate. And of course, we need a much broader debate than just nutrition. And I think that, the impact of it is that it makes the debate seem just to be about nutrition, and it makes it seem as though it's settled. And so, it gives people the idea that organic is just a fad that they can stop thinking about anymore.
You've just heard from Tom Philpott, food and ag blogger for Mother Jones Magazine and co-founder of Maverick Farms. Now we'll conclude the show with Dr. Chuck Benbrook. He's research professor at the Center for Sustaining Agriculture and Natural Resources at Washington State University. He's got a really interesting analysis of the conclusions found in the Stanford study.
Well, that's right. I mean, I have the highest regard for the Stanford Medical School, and I'm sure that the physicians that took on this huge task did so with sincere intentions to try to understand what the literature shows. But they brought the skills of clinicians and physicians who are used to designing clinical trials and studies of the effectiveness of various treatments for human diseases. And frankly, they made some real rookie mistakes in how you approach the plant science and agricultural literature and discipline. And they published their paper in the Annals of Internal Medicine, where the typical paper would look at some complex aspect of the functioning of your endocrine system or your glands or factors leading to diabetes, et cetera. And I think the editors of that journal did not likely reach out broad enough to have reviewers look at the paper that were experienced pesticide toxicologists and risk assessment people, for example, because anyone with much experience would have strongly challenged the metric that the Stanford team used as a measure of quote-unquote pesticide risk. So they were comparing the frequency of residues in organic strawberries versus the frequency of residues in conventional strawberries. Well, the frequency of residues isn't an indicator of pesticide risk. Pesticide risk is a function of how many different pesticides are in food, the levels that they're present, how much is in there, and the toxicity of the chemicals. All of those factors come into play. I've used this analogy to help people understand. You're trying to decide whether to buy a Volkswagen Beetle or a Porsche, and you go into a dealer and you say, well, geez, they both have four tires, so they must run about the same. That's about the level of problems with saying that the frequency of residues is an indicator of pesticide risk.
Taking a step backwards for a moment, I'm curious about the argument over nutrition. We've heard a lot of conflicting responses to this report over that issue. Many people are saying, yes, that is true, that probably organic food is no more nutritious, though we hear other farmers saying, well, it has more to do with the monocrop culture than it has to do with how you really define organic. And other organic farmers have said, if you are an organic farm that has worked the soil for 5, 10, 20, 30 years and has rotated crops and animals, then the soil is very different, and it does make a difference. I'm curious what that part of the report said to you.
They've basically got it right. Whether they're organic or conventional, the impact of farming systems on the nutrient content. And so think of an apple. When we talk about nutrient content, we're talking about the percent of vitamin C in that apple. So it's an issue of concentration. And what all farmers want to do, of course, is produce the most nutrient-dense fruits and vegetables. And in particular, they want to increase the density of those nutrients that we need to be healthier, nutrients like vitamin C and lycopene and resveratrol and a variety of other natural compounds in food that fall under the broad category of antioxidants. Scientists have been studying for 40 years the things that farmers do to a field of broccoli, an orchard of apples, a field of carrots that either drive up or drive down the concentrations of these valuable nutrients in fruits and vegetables. There are many, many factors that can do that in any given year. Many of them are beyond the control of the farmer. In some years, the organic strawberries will have 30% higher levels of vitamin C and antioxidants because the weather conditions kind of favor the organic crop versus the conventional crop. But then another year, it might turn around and the differences might be very minor. We understand a great deal about these factors and how they interact from this entire body of literature. But the Stanford team, using the statistical methods that it did, just missed the forest for the trees. The reason that organic fruits and vegetables about 60% of the time have statistically higher nutrient density than conventional food arises from two different things. One thing is conventional farmers apply extra amounts of readily available nitrogen fertilizer. So a big part of the difference between organic food and conventional food is that this excessive fertilizer on conventional farms, actually, it kind of lowers the nutrient density bar that conventional farmers can reach. It does raise the yield bar, but it lowers the nutrient density bar. Because the crops on an organic farm have to defend themselves, for the most part, against pest attacks, their immune systems become stronger and are more fully triggered. When a plant defends itself against, say, a fungus, just like we defend ourselves against, say, an ear infection, the initial presence of the pest triggers the immune system. These chemicals that drive the plant immune system, these are the antioxidants and, in many cases, the vitamins that we need to eat to be healthy ourselves.
One of the issues brought up in response to this report in a small back and forth that occurred in the New York Times, the organic pesticides used on organic farms is, in fact, more toxic and dangerous than that used in conventional farming, and also more releasing more carbon and more toxic to the environment.
Well, it's just silly. I mean, this argument's been around since people started trying to sell the Brooklyn Bridge, and there's really it's been discredited so many times that I'm sorry to have to do it again, but I will. Organic farmers can use a small number of natural pesticides. These are products that are produced in nature and derived from nature. It is narrowly true that natural, organically approved pyrethrum insecticides, gram for gram, are nearly as toxic as the most toxic conventional pesticides. But they're applied at a far lower rate, and they don't last more than 24 hours. You never find them. Never find them in food that you eat. I can't think of a single study done anywhere in the world that ever found a pyrethrum residue in food as eaten. But I can tell you that most fruits and vegetables that don't come with a thick peel or shell that are in the supermarket today have 1 to 3 insecticides on them, every single one of them. One of the things that the chemical industry did in discovering and manufacturing them was they figured out how to make them more stable so they would last longer and control pests for longer after they were applied. So people that raise this argument, it's kind of a political straw man that gets thrown around. It's like Bruce Ames' assertion that there's more carcinogens in a cup of coffee than all the pesticides in the known universe.
Right, right. Kind of continuing from that point about pesticide use in general and pesticide exposure, you wrote a lot in your response to this piece about pesticide exposures. I mean, here, they missed the point, didn't go far enough, and that there are real risks with pesticide use that they were not taken into account.
Right, and they missed a huge body of literature about human health risk from exposures to pesticides. When they did their literature search, they restricted it to studies that said something about organic farming. Well, most research on the human health effects of pesticides doesn't say anything about organic farming. Whatever the risks are from routine exposures to pesticides in our food, drinking water, and beverages, whatever they are, organic farming essentially eliminates them. Not 100%, but probably 97%, 98%. Science has not documented thoroughly all the ways that pesticide exposures impact human health. But we know people, the average American is being exposed to probably 4 to 8 pesticides through their food on a daily basis.
I mean, you also had a very interesting in your a part of your response talking about benefits of organic food and how that A is how difficult to kind of quantify because it has so many other factors with it. And I wish you would describe that a bit. I thought that was really an interesting piece.
Again, let me return to this analogy of a attainable yield bar. You might think of it as the typical performance of your car in driving a 60-mile race course or something. What you think you can do in most days, what the combination of the car and the driver and the track conditions. But, you know, sometimes it's going to be there's going to be some dew on the track, or it's going to rain, or even some days it'll snow. And there's lots of things that can affect the performance of that car and driver combination in any given year. The same applies in spades to a farming system, where so many different factors can push nutrient levels up and down. But we actually understand a lot about those factors. We have a trade-off that's made between a typical, well-managed, experienced organic farmer, a guy like Nick Marvel, on his farm versus an equally experienced and well-managed conventional farm nearby that's growing the same crops. There's a trade-off. That conventional farm is going to produce a little bit more per acre in most years, but the nutrient density is going to be a bit lower. The organic farmer will produce fruit and vegetables that are smaller. They'll have more nutrients per calorie in them, and they'll probably be a bit tastier because a lot of the so-called phytochemicals that boost the nutrient levels in organic food, these are the chemicals that confer flavor to food. So that's the trade-off that we as a society really have to start to think about as we go forward.
That was Dr. Chuck Benbrook from the Center for Sustaining Agriculture and Natural Resources at Washington State University. And folks, that was just the beginning of this conversation. We're going to come back to a roundtable discussion in the coming weeks with many of our guests and others as we continue to wrestle with the question of how we can feed our nation, organic or conventional, or both, and how do they mix. So don't miss another episode of Soundbites on Delmarva, and I deeply appreciate you listening. Thanks so much. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Justin Levy. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews and Clean Cuts. For WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. Maryland Dream Act makes sure kids who graduated from a Maryland high school and whose parents have paid taxes for at least 3 years can pay in-state tuition. Ballot question 4 in November will determine if some of our young people can pursue their collegiate dreams. For more information, www.educatingmarylandkids.org. That's ballot question 4 on Election Day, November the 6th.